And then grow some more.
We're going to open our Rules Committee hearing today and meeting. Just so people have a little bit of an idea of what we're doing, there's a bill to introduce. It's very late, but there was a little wording problem in a bill we passed last session that had to do with fish and wildlife that we're going to try to get introduced today and move it as quickly as we can. And so our first order of business is I'm going to open a work session for the purpose of introduction of bills.
Chair Rublin.
Representative Berger.
I move LC 246 dated February 15, 2010 be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Berger moves LC 246 dated February 15, 2010 to be introduced as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? If you want to know, it's a may shall issue about we passed some fairly strict new penalties for poaching and other kinds of issues. And in that bill, there was a deal that said shall instead of may with regard to losing your license. So the most minor of violations could cause you to lose your license. That was not the intention. We'd like that to be made. That's what this bill does to introduce. So, is there any further discussion? Any objection to the introduction? Seeing none, so ordered. We'll close the work session on introduction of bills. The next order of business will be to open a public hearing on House Bill. Well, before I do that, I should introduce our new member. Would you like to say something? We do have a new member to the Rules Committee, Mr. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. It's an honor to be here. I was just saying that I feel like I'm in tryouts.
And you represent?
I represent Inner Southeast and Northeast Portland, Ms. Chair.
Very good. Thank you very much. With that, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3673. I'll have a short explanation by our committee administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3673 modifies laws governing immunities provided to landowners who allow use of their land for recreational purposes, gardening, woodcutting, or harvesting of special forest products as follows. Removes a day late parking fee of, insert the amount here, from the definition of charge. Provides that if a landowner imposes a charge in excess of a specified amount for a listed use of land, immunity still applies to other uses for which no charge was imposed. Provides that if a landowner imposes a charge in excess of a specified amount for use of a particular area of land, immunity still applies to the remainder of land. The committee has before it also -4 amendment. This requires a landowner to provide notice in order to retain immunities and defines what constitutes proper notice, and it removes the fee for a winter recreation parking permit or any other parking permit of $15 or less per day. It fills in that blank from the definition of charge.
And so we're going to call up our first three witnesses, and I want to acknowledge that I have one of my county commissioners here who actually brought this to my attention early, just about the time the session was starting. So it was kind of a push to try to figure out if we could do something here. So with that, I'll invite Nikki Witte, Paul Snyder, and Tim Wood up. So, with that, let's go with our Ms. Witte.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we appreciate very much this becoming a committee bill and being introduced. We did provide written testimony. Our testimony was written before we saw the -4 amendments. So we want you to know that we support the bill with those amendments. And I listed a couple of other things that we don't have time to deal with this session, but maybe we could look at them for future sessions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. I testified to the committee a month ago about the background before the bill. I'd like to just emphasize a couple of things that caused us to bring this bill forward. There is a statute, ORS 105672 to 105696, that includes, among other things, a public policy, and the policy is stated by the legislature as being to encourage owners of land to make their land available to the public for recreational purposes, wood cutting, harvest of special forest products, and by limiting their liability toward persons entering thereon and for such other purposes as protecting their interests. That bill's been on the books since 1995, and in September of last year, the Oregon Supreme Court issued a 4-3 opinion that caused a great deal of concern among our members and others as well. And what the Supreme Court did was to say that if you charge for one of these activities in excess of the amount that's authorized, or if there's no fee authorized, if you charge anything, then you lose your recreational immunity both for all purposes and for all parts of your land. Maybe. And the reason for the maybe is that the state argued in that case, well, if we have 100 acres of which we have devoted 2 acres to equestrian purposes, and we charge for the equestrian purposes but not for the other 98 acres, are you saying we lose immunity for the 98 acres? And the Supreme Court said, well, we don't have enough facts before us to rule on that issue, so bring it to us in another case or another time. The dissent said, we think there are enough facts there, and the facts should dictate that recreational immunity should apply. So what House Bill 3673 does, the printed bill, is to say that if you charge a fee for a recreational purpose, then the immunity still applies to the other purposes for which you do not charge, and it also applies for the area of the land for which you do not charge. And we had conversations among a number of interests that would have an interest in this bill, and several of them will testify this afternoon. One of those interests was with the folks who usually represent people in personal injury cases, and they identified for us some issues that they felt should be addressed by the bill. So that's what the Dash 4 amendments do. We did the Dash 2 and the Dash 3 amendments, and then others developed the Dash 4 amendments in response to what we did. Today, the AOC Legislative Committee has endorsed this bill with the Dash 4 amendments. And what the Dash 4 amendments do is to say that if you do this, you have to provide some notice. And the notice has to include a reference to what are the activities for which you're charging, and what is the area of the land for which you're charging, and what immunities would still apply. Essentially, that's what the bill would do. Now, we first saw the Dash 4 amendments early this morning, and we passed them out to the group who had developed our issue. And one of them responded back by saying, well, we want to be sure that with the Dash 4 amendments that the reference in subsection 8 on page 2 of the Dash 4 amendments says that if you give notice either by posting or part of a receipt or any other means as may reasonably be calculated to appraise the person of either the limited use of the land for which the charge is made and therefore the immunities that are provided, or the portion of the land that is subject to the charge and therefore the immunities that are provided, then you'll retain immunity for these other things. And the comment that was made was, well, we want to be sure that we can do this in the alternative, or we can do both. So we can cover both the land and the activity in the same notice or in separate notices, and as long as it qualifies as reasonably calculated to appraise the person, that covers it. And so it's our hope that that's the view that the committee will take when we pass the bill out. I would like to thank all the people who participated in developing this bill. There were a number of different interests, and as I mentioned, folks who usually represent plaintiffs in personal injury cases were among them. And I'd frankly like to thank them in particular for the work that they did in helping us to develop a bill that I believe now is not opposed by anybody. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Tim Wood, the director of the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and I'm also here to support House Bill 3673 with the -4 amendments. We believe this will strengthen the laws that provide landowners with limited reasonable immunities when the public uses land for recreational purposes. The limitations on liability are important to ensure ongoing access without charge to Oregon's recreational lands, be they public or private. The bill seeks to restore the intent of the recreational use statutes that we, so that we can continue to operate based on our ongoing assumptions about recreational use immunities on parklands that we understood to exist prior to the Supreme Court decision. We in no way wish to abdicate our responsibilities to provide safe outdoor recreation experiences. The immunity still holds us to a standard of maintenance and safety for our grounds and facilities that would never limit our liability for intentional injury or damage. However, we cannot control every act of nature or personal behavior which could pose a hazard to people while using our land. Mr. Snyder has pretty well summed up the intent of the bill and the support that's come together for this, and I'd like to acknowledge AOC's leadership in bringing this bill to this point. The same immunity that we're talking about here applies not only to state lands, but to county and private lands as well, creating the kind of statewide recreation network that Oregonians tell us they need. And I urge you to support this bill to ensure that we can continue to provide open access to Oregon State Park properties and public and private recreation properties across the state. Thank you.
Any questions for these witnesses?
Do you have others to testify?
Yes, there are a couple.
Okay. Okay, thank you both, all three of you. Next we have, is it Mike Dykstra? I always get that wrong, Mike, I'm sorry.
Okay.
And Scott Winkles.
I always look at that and go
blank on how to pronounce it.
You're not alone, you won't be the first nor the last. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Dykstra. I'm the Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council here in Salem. I'd like to echo Mr. Snyder's comments about the bill, the collaboration that took place, and also appreciate OTLA's help in finding a solution to the kind of touchy notice issue. So OFIC is on record in supporting the bill, including the -4 amendments, but I would like to take a little bit of a twist here for the committee's consideration. Is it's very important to understand where those liabilities and immunities exist in statute. The four areas of activities that are currently under statute is the woodcutting, the gardening, the recreational purposes, and also the harvesting of minor forest products. I find it very interesting that two of them have a not to exceed amount, whereas two of them do not. There is a growing need of public recreational opportunities on public and private lands. I wish I could say that everybody respected the difference between public and private lands. Not everybody does. There are some bad behaviors by a few, but do create problems and an anxiety for folks to open their lands to the public. And by considering not to exceed charge, it would help individual landowners help offset some of the costs associated with some of the damage that occurs, whether it's gates, road maintenance, vandalism, a number of different bad behaviors. So I didn't want to do anything to impede the progress of the bill on this short string here on the time frame, but I would appreciate the committee's consideration of maybe an interim work group, which was suggested earlier. Maybe there's a couple of the things that would need to get worked out. But the potential of establishing a not-to-an-exceed amount for recreational purposes as well as the harvest of minor forest products, I think it would take some time to kind of really tweak the exact amount that wouldn't go either way. So I appreciate your consideration on that.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. I want to thank Mr. Snyder's leadership on this issue, and I will not repeat his excellent testimony, other than to say that the Coleman decision was very concerning to the League of Oregon Cities. The scenario we were faced with without the adoption of 3673 and the Dash 4 amendments is one where the city could rent a gazebo or other picnic structure at a park to one party. A member of that party could go off, become injured in a playground or in some other portion of the property for which no charge has been requested, and the city would be liable for that injury if a person who had not been part of rented a play structure in a gazebo or picnic facility, come into the park, no fee, simply walked in, they suffer an injury, the city would have would have immunity from that injury. Typically, cities have been operating under the presumption that we've had recreational immunity on our parks since the adoption of the 1995 law. Our insurance, Kiss City County Insurance Service, has been reserving funds based on the belief that we had that immunity. And this 3673 simply ensures that belief is that we are correct in that, and provides the public with sufficient clarity so they know where their immunity ends and begins. With that, I'm eager for your questions.
Questions?
A couple.
Representative Burkert.
A couple. First one, Scott, you are speaking to the Dash 4. You are in
Correct.
Approval of the Dash 4. So, okay, thank you. I'm going to make sure that's on the record. And Mr. Dykstra, just for my own edification, special interest forest products are things like mushrooms, ferns?
There's a whole host of issues out there. It could be ferns, salal, bear grass, mushrooms, boughs, bark, you name it.
I just wanted that on the record since we're...
Appreciate that.
Exactly clear.
Other questions for this?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Winkles, I just want to address the form of notice in the Dash 4 amendment. I certainly think it's appropriate for the public to be notified, but I want to make sure we're not creating an undue burden on landowners in terms of the obligation to notify. Maybe Mr. Winkles, I'm addressing you, but Mr. Dykstra looks like he has something to say about that too. I want to make sure we're clear about that.
Chair Roblin, Representative Nolan, excuse me. We've had some conversations with the League General Counsel and attorneys, and we think there is a way to address the appropriate signage so that it would not be an undue burden. I think there will be some burden in creating the signage, but compared to the uncertain exposure to liability, we'll take that.
Chair Roble and Representative Nolan, we had the same concerns from the very beginning. As you can imagine, someone with 50,000, 100,000, 500,000 acres of land, how do you sign it? How do you fence it? We really wanted to stay away from that and find a way where you could go ahead and actually identify it. So I think the provisions in the Dash 4s signify that you may. If it's an area like the gazebo in the park, you could put some signage around, go ahead. But you could go ahead in a larger area, go ahead on the receipt, go ahead and identify as you take funds to go ahead and identify what the activity is for, provide a map to attach to it of where the area exists, and provide details in that manner.
Thank you, gentlemen. And it just seems to me that while it's appropriate to have landowners have some affirmative responsibility to notice, I think we also should continue to expect that the public should be aware of all the laws of the state, and ignorance is not a defense. I think the same should apply as well. Individual users of the land should exercise due diligence and care.
Appreciate that.
Not a question, but just a statement from mine. I'm really appreciative of all the people that came together in a short period of time to look at this issue. And I think the one thing, it goes to what Representative Nolan was saying. There is a real belief in this state that we want our citizens to be able to use the great outdoors as a shared place. We would hope everybody would be responsible, and I agree totally with responsibility, and I know that some private landowners have opened their place up for hunting, and because of misuse by people, they finally decided, no, I'm not going to do that anymore. And they have absolutely that right to do that. And I appreciate that right. I appreciate the fact that they really want to open their lands to appropriate uses. And Oregon is pretty well known for that. And this bill is a example of people coming together and saying, yeah, we do cherish those kinds of opportunities for families and other people to use it for biking and hiking and all those other kinds of things. But it would be difficult for private landowners in particular. I think the state has a different obligation. We have that for all of us, but when it comes to those private people opening up trails and stuff to ride bikes and stuff through, that's a pretty big thing for them. And there's no real right. They don't have any responsibility to do that. It's a choice they've made in our state, and I appreciate that, and I think it goes to what Representative Nolan was saying, and responsible use of those things. Hopefully, people are responsible for all of their different uses, but I am pleased that this bill had the amount of effort that a lot of people put into it to get it to a point where I think we can do it. We're missing
physical impact statements
right now, so I guess I might as well announce because we're getting very close to the end and any of these bills moving need to get going quickly, we are going to schedule a meeting for work sessions only tomorrow at 2:30. If by the end of 5:30 we don't get those things delivered here, we will have a 2:30 meeting tomorrow to work at just work sessions on whatever bills that we need to do that. So I just want to let people know that that's kind of in advance of that. So we're going to, is there anybody else that came to talk to House Bill 3673? Seeing no one, I thank you for that. And we will close our public hearing on House Bill 3673, and we'll open a work session when we need to if we get those appropriate documents, and if not, we'll set it off as a work session for tomorrow. Right now, because I mentioned this before when we had our hearing, I'm going to open public hearing on 3704. And we had a hearing last week. It went fairly quickly. A lot of people mentioned to me that they couldn't get here, so we are going to open a hearing and invite some testimony. We'll keep it fairly short, because we have a lot of things to do today, but I do want to have the public hearing before I make a decision as to whether we're moving this bill or not. So with that, and we'll just go down the list. Let's just go with Joe Gilliam to first, and then we have a group of people who are against who weren't here before. So Joe, welcome.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Gilliam, representing Northwest Grocery Association. We're here today on 3704, as we were last week. Just want to offer some clarifying points to the bill. We had very good testimony last week from both sides, and I think there was some good discussion, but I think we got off a little bit on the purpose of the bill. And so thank you for giving me just a few minutes to kind of restate our need for the bill. This bill is not about the distributors that testified last week and the OBRC. This bill is generic in terms of addressing Senate Bill 707, and specifically Section 2 of that bill, which requires universal collection from retailers of all brands of the types of beverages they sell. And that's really the focus of the bill. It's not the differences between the good distributors from the east side of the state and Corvallis and Astoria and OBRC. It's our ability to implement the expansion of water bottles and the universal collection point being the retailers. The fact that we now don't have to, that we now are required to accept brands we don't sell, we have to bring in everybody's brands into our stores, and those have to be collected and or sorted in a way that they can be redeemed to the nickels can pass to the consumer and the nickels can pass from wholesaler to the retailer so everybody's whole. I left you a picture today. That's my only attachment. I don't know if you have it there in front of you. It's just a picture. That shows you what the retail room would look like due to Section 2 of Senate Bill 707 if there was no statewide cooperative. You're looking at 84 different distributors, each represented by a box in there. And that's what we would be doing, separating each bag of containers, running them back to the back room, and resorting them in each one of those boxes. OVRC happens to be the cooperative of choice because they've got 95% of distributors. So all these boxes you see in front of you are condensed into three stacks of totes, glass, plastic, and aluminum, that stack against the wall and would take up about a third of the space of what you're seeing in the back room here, and literally hundreds of thousands of dollars in labor costs that are saved because they go in the totes and they're removed all at once. The labor costs associated with sorting 84 plus the gentlemen that have come in and testified against the bill, all their different brands, is literally in the hundreds of thousands of dollars every year for the retailers to have bottle boys and girls running around sorting bottles and cans. 3704 has nothing to do whether they come to agreement with OBRC or they don't come to agreement with OBRC. And I hope they do at some point, but it's okay if they don't. And if they did and we didn't have this bill, then there'd be six more distributors who decide, I'm not coming in. Or it'll be at a time of expansion when you add Gatorade and teas, and someone says, I'm not in. You've asked us to be the universal collection point, and this bill finishes the job. It allows us to have a universal collection point out the back door. It's up to distributors whether they can negotiate their own terms and how they're going to deal with the state mandate, just like the retailer has. But it's not fair to put all the costs of distributors onto the retailers. We're doing our part. And I appreciate Representative Berger's comments last week. She's acknowledged that. And we've butted heads hard on this issue. I still got a bruise. But we've remained friends over it. And we've come around. So that's the biggest part of this bill, is to understand this isn't about just this small group of distributors. We're not creating a monopoly. In fact, we're preventing one. You don't have to join. You don't have to join any cooperative. And the fact of the matter is, in this bill, if everything dissipated and the group decided half of them left, this bill wouldn't apply. We would be in, it would look like this. I'd probably be back with a different bill in 2000 or whatever. But it would look like this in our back rooms because no one has a gun to their head requiring to stay. We would support the dash. I don't want to confuse you. We would support the Dash 1 amendments, and we would oppose the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 2 amendments are just basically, we'd pass the law and then we'd unwind it again by saying if you're a particular type of distributor, the law doesn't apply to you. If you want Section 2 to work of Senate Bill 707 and universal collection of any brand at any retailer, then you really have two choices to make it work mechanically. You have this choice here, or repeal Section 2 and put it back to the old way so we don't have to do this in our back rooms. We'll just deal with the distributors we sell to. I hope you will notice that we did not come in with that bill to unwind 707. We came with a bill to make it work efficiently. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Greer.
Thank you. Joe, have all attempts at any kind of arbitration or negotiation on this issue, have they pretty well been exhausted, in your opinion?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, for the retail community, they have. Our mandate came in as of January 1, 2009. We did have about 18 months period of time to get ready for this. We went through the Bottle Bill Task Force, and our mandate for universal collection came in January 1, over a year ago. I've had one meeting with these folks. I know John Anderson has had a zillion meetings with them, and nothing's come to fruition, and we're still dealing with it in the back room. So I hope they continue to negotiate. But again, Representative Girard, let's say they all come to terms and we sing kumbaya and have a big can fight in the backyard. What about the next guys who don't want? What happens if a big distributorship sells to an out-of-state company and say, I don't get the bottle bill, we're out? What about Gatorade? What about iced teas when they come in? For us to accommodate, do it efficiently, and be a player in this, we have to have some protections that our system's not blown apart because a distributor behind us just decides to blow it apart. We haven't asked for much in this. We got millions of dollars on the line, and I respect the cost these guys are into. The gentleman from Astoria is in $100,000 for his plastic machine. We're in millions of dollars for all our machines and all our labor costs. And I truly respect the cost he's into, but we're into it too, at your behest.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Gilliam, for your testimony. I was curious about the photograph that you submitted. Can you tell me how it was created?
That photograph was a back room, and it represents every distributor that's at OBRC. So 95% of the distributors are represented in this picture. So if we didn't have an OBRC or anything like it, this is what our back room would have to look like in order to sort out all the cans. The second piece of this that I didn't say is, not only would we have to sort out, we'd have to wait for each distributor to come get that box. So it wouldn't be one big load out the back door and then new empty boxes. It might be three one day, two the next. We'd have to look in, how full is it, call that distributor to come get all these.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Is it an actual photograph?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, this is just to stage it, because we don't have any of these rooms. If we didn't have a cooperative, this is what it would look like. To give you an example, Representative Reed, in some areas of the state, we have the totes that all stack up, and then we have four or five boxes that have to be separated just for a distributor who doesn't want to be in the process. Those have to sit separately and be sorted separately.
Thank you. That's helpful. I noticed on one side there's, I think it's a Widmer case, and then it appears that it's on the opposite side and the lettering is backwards, so I was having trouble.
No, that out. It's to represent the 84
very helpful
people that would be in the group.
Thank
You're
you.
Welcome.
Thank
you. Other questions for this witness?
Yes. Your image.
I want to say that I do appreciate the work that continues to be going done and has been done. And in particular, the fact that we can still drop stuff off at those doors. The person that has a six-pack wants to drop it off. That's kind of nice. And you still take all of those. And I know we're looking at distributors in the future. I mean, centers in the future. But it has groceries have allowed this to happen. I appreciate the work that they've done, too.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you. Now we have a group of people, and some we heard from last week, but Russ Strandhouse, Ron Bruce, and is it Bill Wynn?
Yes.
Okay. If you want to come up together. Sorry, I just want to, Representative Gilliam, nice of you to be here. Did you want to testify?
No, but thank you.
Okay, just wanted to make sure. Sorry, we like to make sure that those representatives sometimes have to come back and forth, and I just wanted to acknowledge that, so thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for listening to us, and we were here last
week.
Don't
forget your name.
Yeah, Ron Bruce, Pepsi, La Grande, Oregon.
Thank you.
Thank you again. Just real quick points. We don't charge a fee to pick up redemption at stores, nor do we charge it at distributors. I don't know if that was brought up last week. We do not charge a fee for commingling of products cans, plastic, nor bottles. Second, we don't receive a reporting document from UPCs, from OBRC, from the back room of some of the major grocery stores stating what they pick up, what we pick up, what our fellow beverage distributors pick up. And last, it's a little personal, but we were called by Mr. Romaine. We were called free riders last Thursday, and I just want to reiterate the fact that we are not. The last fellow that testified stated that we have Mr. Van Dusen from Astoria. He has over $100,000 of equipment to crush cans and bottles, as do we and some of the other members here. And we take pride in the way we take care and service our people in Eastern Oregon. And, you know, at Mr. Marquis's request, we've all agreed to work towards a mediation process with OBRC in this fact. So I appreciate your time, and if you have any questions, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify. I'm Russ Strandholm from Pendleton. Kind of the concern that I have is the co-op, and co-ops I feel are real good. You know, we have them in the grain industry, and it's kind of a cost-sharing issue. You know, if you join together, you can drive down costs out of your operation. After listening to Joe speak, I think he kind of needs some type of co-op, and ours is a kind of a little bit different type of co-op. You know, we're both working for the ultimate goal, but and it does work good for the grocery stores. But to be forced into joining where it's going to increase my costs by like in the $80,000 a year range, that's prohibitive. You know, and it states right in here that you have to go with the majority recycler in the state of Oregon, which for sure, the I-5 corridor is going to be the majority. So I just feel that it's just, we need to come together, be it a mediator through Portland State University or something, to work out these problems so we can get things, you know, put together and get this thing put to bed. And as far as in the state of Oregon, there is 65 members, and there's 41 non-members. And we could get together that list if you'd like it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you for giving the time for me to speak. I'm not very good at this, but I'll do the best I can. My name is Bill Wynn. I'm from Owyhee Distributing in Nessa, Oregon. And I know you're really busy, but I'm going to paint a picture of what a small distributor is on the other side of the state. My father started in 1953 selling beer and beverages. I started working with them when I was 14, riding on the beer trucks, very small company. Then it was him and me on the trucks in the summer. Then I went to work for my father full-time in 1973. I bought the family business in 1990 from my father so he could retire. I'm still paying him. I'm getting a little tired of that, but I'm still paying him. So I've been paying him for, 20 years now. This is our 57th year in business, and I'm proud of that. I employ 14 people. Some of them are still family members today. 10 of them are full-time. I pay 100% of their medical benefits. They don't have to pay a penny. I can pay for their families. I pay 100% of their retirement packages. They don't have to match it or anything like that. I pay 100% of their long-term, short-term disability packages. I offer them accident and cancer insurance. I give them paid vacation and sick leave. And I give them family wage jobs. Again, this is Ness, Oregon. And my community credentials, I've been on the chairman of the board for the City of Chamber of Commerce, chairman of the board of the local college. I've been a fireman for 10 years, volunteer fire department, local town. Been the grand marshal for every parade they have in our little town, you know, for the rodeos and the Christmas parades. So that's what a small distributor looks like on the other side of the state. Very small company. How important is it is that I'm here today to talk about this? I raised my granddaughter. I took her out of school and I drove 500 miles to get here. You know, it's almost 500 miles. Long trip yesterday. Have to go back tomorrow. How do I feel about this bill? I feel very strongly against it. It worries me that they can legislate one business to control another business. I mean, like, we've been doing this for 57 years, and it feels like a monopoly to me versus free enterprise. You know, our carbon footprint, we go to these stores, we pick up all the empties just like we're mandated to do, we take care of it for them. We do, so it's very efficient. I mean, the truck's there, we take the products off the truck, we put the garbage, the recycling stuff, back on the truck, we take it back to our warehouse, we separate it, and we take care of our customers. OBRC goes to those retailers in our area, I think three of them out of 70 retailers, once a week. We go to our retailers, the big ones, three times a week, and they will call us and say they have more garbage, and that's what I call it, but we recycle it, of course, and pick it up for them, because we're local. You know, we know them all. They know us. One thing that would be good for you folks to do is call the retailers on the other side of the state and see how they feel about OBRC. One day a week service versus three times a week service, and we're there when they need us. I mean, they're a long ways away. Like I say, ask questions of the retailers. I can give you the telephone numbers. You can talk to the managers at Walmart or Albertsons or Red Apple if you'd like to, the big grocery stores over there, how they feel about this. And yes, they are probably members of the association of the gentleman that just spoke, but they're 500 miles away or 400 miles away, whichever retailer you're talking about. And they don't feel as strongly about OBRC as he does. It does bother me that this bill kind of supports a mega business against small family businesses. Like I said, my company is Hawaii Distributing. I'm still working it. I'm the second generation. My son's working with it, the second generation. Russ here, two families, his father and his sons, father and son. Achanis Distributing, my other competitor, father and two sons. Let's see, P&E Distributing, which I think he spoke last week, father and two sons. You have these small family businesses that seem to be able to thrive and do well if they let us. I want to talk about my history with OBRC, and it's not good. My first meeting with them was in Pendleton right before the plastic bottles went in, so it was probably October, and that started in January. I asked Mr. Anderson myself, I said, why don't we do this? We're already there. We're already taking care of our customers. We know this has to be taken care of. Why don't we pick up those extra bottles, plastic bottle waters for you for free? All you have to do is make us whole. Once we pick them up, give us our nickel back because we didn't sell them. And his response, and there was a lot of folks in the room, including Mr. Paul Romaine, who I think testified last week, he said, we can't be trusted. That's why I gave the speech about who I am and who these other guys are. Well, all parts of our community is, well, we can't be trusted. And, you know, that bothered me. The second meeting, so of course I didn't sign up with OBRC because I can't be trusted. You know, it's just against my grain. Second meeting, we had a nice young man came to my office and I said, you know, I'd like to be a part of the solution instead of a part of the problem. Come and meet with me and explain to me exactly how this works. Well, when he was done, he said it would cost me $28,000 a year. This was on the proposal for 2009. And I would still do 100% of the labor. He still wanted me to pick up as many empties as I am now and charge me $28,000 a year. Now, as a businessman that still unloads the beer trucks, loads the beer trucks, cleans the warehouse. It didn't sound like a very good deal to me, and I told them I was not interested. In a small company like ours, we pay those family wage jobs, but in 2008, my company made about $30,000. 2009, I'm going to lose about $20,000. But all of us made a wage, I paid the debt down, again, I paid my father, and we keep going. But when you get offered a deal like that, sign it or we will legislate you to sign it, it isn't very fair. I don't think it's fair. So in closing, and I hope I haven't taken too long, if we're not doing it right, chastise us, you know, punish us. But we're doing it right. All of us being picked up, we're taking care of it, we're doing it responsibly. But the other thing that I would like to see is maybe some mediation. If there's costs that we can get out of the system by working with OBRC, shared services is what I would call it, then let's do so. We're willing to meet, but it's got to be a compromise and not a do it or else. In Eastern Oregon, when people tell us do it or else, we usually pick the or else. So folks, I want to thank you for your time. But as you can see, it's a tough decision for us to even want to do this when it's such a, it's not fair.
Any questions of this panel? Representative Nolan.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that my question is of this panel so much as it is perhaps of our own staff. And that is, have we had an analytical look at the jobs impact of this bill, private sector jobs? I'm hearing from some small businesses, someone who's been successful in moving from a dad and son to now employing 10 people full-time. Do we know what the jobs, private sector jobs impact of this legislation is on Oregon businesses? By itself or with any amendments? And I don't know that you have the answer, but I'd like to ask our staff to look at that, yeah.
And I guess the question I ask you, because I've asked these other people before, as the bill's written right now, you don't have to belong. What happens is you would lose your refund, I mean the recycling, is that about it? Because recycling would go to ORBC?
Right, I believe that's the way it is. We'd lose our our recycling, which there is value in aluminum, depending on what the market does. The OBRC, and that wouldn't come back to us. When you go to a retailer in Eastern Oregon, and you can go talk to them, they'll have a cage, and it's got bags of aluminum, it's got bags of plastic. The aluminum seems to always disappear, and the plastic, nobody wants it, because there's no value there. It's just, I mean, you take it, and you bale it, and you sell it, and you get 10 cents a pound. You bale aluminum, and you're getting 80 cents a pound. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, so is it part of, I mean, that's what you would lose, and that's, I mean, you were just saying $26,000 is what it was going to cost you.
Yes.
Is that, you would lose more than that with the
actually,
because I don't think it's telling you you have to join the organization.
Well, but if they take that money away from us and we have to pay them, and again, how are they going to do the accounting? They say they don't trust us. How do we trust them? And I think there really does need to be some mediation. But there's the cost. Let's say, okay, and I can use the numbers off my business if you'd like me to. This last year, the redemption rate in my area was 91%. With all the products that I sell, because I'm such a small business, I do beer, I do wine, I do soft drinks, I do snacks, I do jerky, all those sort of things. Bottled waters to make a living. That's how I went from just my dad and I on a beer truck to 10 people. Diversification. But we do make some money on aluminum. It costs me about $500 a month to get rid of the glass, okay? And then there's the labor. But that aluminum helps offset the cost and makes us a little bit of income. Not much. And the reason I say a little bit is because you pay your employees to go do these things, and part of their job is doing the recycling.
Right.
And I've never really, it's tough to decipher how much time they spend just on working the garbage versus selling the bottles or whatever they're selling. So So if they charge me $28,000 last year, and this is where I'll get to the numbers, and I'm going to be really close, I made about $12,000 on unredeemed deposits. I made, I think, about $12,000 on the aluminum. So you can see it's about a break-even thing. I think the biggest issue is the do it or else. We will legislate you. We will make you, we will take away the money, and it's not the right way to go about things. Work together. Let's figure out a solution that works for all of us instead of saying we will just take it away from you. I don't think that's fair. That's not how it should work, especially when, in my mind, it's a really, really big company from the other side of the state that's coming 400 miles into my territory and telling me what I'm going to do. Now, if we weren't recycling, then we would deserve to be beat up. But we are. We're picking it all up. And when OBRC doesn't get there what they should, they don't call them. They call me. Or they call these guys and say, come and get another load of bottles or cans.
Short comment. Did you want to say something as well?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Nolan, we would lose two.
Okay.
One in our LeGrand facility and one in our Ontario facility, to answer your question. We'd lose two people.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. And we have three more. Willis Van Duzel, Ken Pastega, and Jim Markey. Oh, I'm sorry. I think I missed Ed. Is it Klein? Elmer? Ellis?
I'm sorry.
Did I miss you as well?
Yes, Ed.
Okay.
Ellis.
Do you want to go after this group or do you want to come sit up here with this group?
After them is fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
I missed you on the line, so thanks. Sorry.
Sure. Well, my name, Mr. Chairman and Committee, my name is Ken Pastega from Corvallis, Oregon, and like last week, we service Jackson, Josephine, Polk, Benton, Lynn, and Tillamook counties in the state of Oregon. Our family's been in business since I was a year old. I'm 63, and since 1948. Anyway, first I wanted to clarify the last comment from our individual from the grocery industry, Mr. Gilliam. This is what the back front of the store looks like today. There is an 84 boxes in the back room. And basically, like a statement earlier was made, we pick up the bags of aluminum. They're beer cans, Pepsi cans, Coke cans. They're all mixed together. There's no sorting anymore. This equipment reads the UPC code, bills whatever company, gives us a total of how much redemption's been taken care of by that store, and we just pick up our fair share. There's not any handling other than they have to take all the bags to the back room, but they take all the bags to the back room regardless. So our semi trucks back up, we pick up our fair share, the OBRC truck picks up their fair share, and everybody goes away, and the customer's whole, and the grocer's taken care of without a lot of effort anymore. Compared to what the 84 bags used to exist before these machines were implemented in 1997. So it's been 13 years ago that this type of equipment's out there. So they're being taken care of now with without a lot of effort. Last week when we were here, Mr. Featherstone, Barry made a comment about, kind of questioned our integrity as a business. Like we all voted that it was that we were not doing our fair part, or the statement was not correct. Anyway, last year our family was awarded a ethics honor by the Portland Rotary Club and the Willamette University for being in business and being honest about what we do. We do it honestly, or we wouldn't be in business today. One of the things that we talked about last week was the cost. And Representative Nolan asked how many people right now for us to participate in this organization. It cost us 15 employees, okay? And they would shift away probably from a very excellent benefits program, probably not as good as the wage level that they're receiving now in our organization. Your committee, the the opposition for against us is trying to leverage their size. We're very small businesses, all based in Oregon. If you look at the members of OBRC, they're billion-dollar corporations, and not any of them located in the state of Oregon. We're here. We're committed to our communities, just like some of the individuals communicated earlier in their testimony. And our family contributes a lot to the communities that we do business in, and we'll continue to do that as long as we stay in business. But this is kind of another thing, as far as I'm concerned, that is the Spill Knight made the comment the other day about assisted suicide in business in the state of Oregon. The larger corporation can leverage against us day in and day out. We still survive, but it's pretty wrong for them to be able to legislate a bill in their favor that costs us revenue and moves the expenses from our side of the ledger and reduces their side of the ledger. We're providing good services right now to make sure the bottle bill, which is part of the legacy of the state of Oregon, the first state to put this in place, and we're doing our fair share to accomplish everything that the Oregon Bottle Bill stands for right now. I think that we have, I know I have sat down with OBRC before, and I think I communicated that earlier in my testimony last week, that we were basically told that it wasn't possible for them to make any changes to help us come into their organization. And just like Jim has suggested and we've agreed to, if there is mediation, we'd be more than happy to sit down and find a solution without spending your valuable time on a situation that business should fix on their own. And that's the end of my comments. I appreciate your time, and if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Willis Van Dusen, and I'm the Dr. Pepper bottler from Astoria. And I was here last week, and I'm not going to repeat my testimony. What I would like to add is an argument for mediation. Now, it may appear to some in the state and in the industry that there's been a lot of negotiation going on for a long, long time. Well, as far as Van Dusen Beverages in Astoria, that is really not true. And I demonstrated that by purchasing this big, expensive piece of equipment for a small company after the law was passed. Now, so I think we deserve a chance for mediation. Now, when Mr. Gilliam spoke about the grocer side of view, point of view, I agree with him, and there is a separation that's required in the back room of those stores, and the worst one is glass, the glass. Now, there's three commodities. There's the aluminum, there's plastic, and there's glass, and they're all three a problem for the grocers, but they're all different value. And during this mediation session, if the mediator would choose one group to, the aluminum's got the value, so I think during the mediation, the aluminum would have to stay where it is. But if the mediator would say, all right, those on one side pick up all the glass and all the plastic, and to help the grocers during this mediation period, their back rooms are a mess. And if we sit here and say they don't have a problem with separation, they do. And it's no fun dealing with broken glass or plastic bags. But mediation is fair. And it's fair to give the grocers a break during this mediation period. And there are ways to do that. And there has been movement during the negotiations since this bill was passed. I touched on that last week, and I won't go through it again. But I truly believe that there is some possibility of mediation. There's just no question. And so I just ask that you consider. It'd have to be a mediator. We can't just put the two groups in a room and shut the door. If there was an independent person to tell each group to get off the dime, instead of trying to put two opposite views at the same time, I don't think that would be as effective as if you, Mr. Chair, or whoever, would appoint a mediator, an individual. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Markey, representing Hodgin Distributing in Pendleton, Oregon. And these folks came to us, and we have met with them and talked with them a lot about this issue, and I don't pretend certainly to be an expert on the issue, but I know something about negotiations, and I can tell you that from what I've heard from both sides of this issue, this has gone on long enough that levels of distrust exist that are going to require some professional help to make any headway at all. And so I suggested that in lieu of this bill that authorize these folks to take part in some kind of formal mediation process, and I would suggest using the Oregon Solutions program at Portland State University. I've had wonderful experience with them in a couple of other areas. The entire group of distributors who have not joined the OBRC have agreed to participate in that. I think, you know, if you move forward with that kind of process, you're going to have to let everybody know that if they don't solve this problem, you'll solve it for them next January, and I'm sure you would. But I think there is an opportunity here that exists. I did speak with Mr. Romaine about this, and he frankly told me he's not very interested in moving forward with that, so I'm not sure where that leaves us. You'll have to ask him about that, and I'm sure he has his own reasons. So I think our folks are ready to sit down and try to do this with some professional help, and I'd like to see them have the opportunity to do that. So thank you.
Thank you. We had one person. Oh, questions for this group?
I got a question.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ken, you know the respect I have for your family in this business is top-notch. You characterized OBRC as membership of billion-dollar companies. Have you looked at the membership list?
Well, I look at it from a standpoint of the majority of the, if you look at the board of OBRC, it looks like to me, and I haven't seen it lately other than Barry is now on it, which represents a small distributor, but and probably Willamette Beverage out of Eugene, but after that, they're pretty large. And I know there's yourselves involved in it, and there are some small individuals in the organization.
Okay, because yes. you were pumping my ego, thinking no. I got it. That's a bigger bottler than I thought, you know. And I liked it. I liked it in the thought process, but fortunately, I'm a hometown bottler like you all. Secondly, are you aware of the ongoing changes with fee structure at OBRC?
We are.
Okay. So you've had that conversation, and
we've had a brief conversation with that. And at one point in time, Barry called me last week and asked me on Monday of last week if I'd be interested in handling some of the recycling in Southern Oregon, not in the Corvallis location, but in Southern Oregon. And I said, well, I'd like to see how this proposal affects the other independent distributors before I would participate in something like that. And so I think the mediation process would be a good solution to this situation.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you all.
Mr. Chair, may I address a question to my fellow Dr. Pepper bottler?
In general, we don't ask questions of the people up here. Sorry about that.
Okay.
But you can get offline and talk to him.
Pardon me?
You can ask him later. I'm sure he'll answer your question.
Thank you.
No, I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's okay.
Thank you.
But we appreciate it. And I appreciate you coming back twice, both of you. We have one more person that I got, Ed. Is it Klein?
Yes.
Okay. And Paul, I'd love to ask this. I'd love to have you come on and answer our question, too. So you can come up and sit now if you want, or you can wait. Either way.
I don't know.
I know him. We're safe.
Okay.
Mr.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ed Elms. I'm from Baker City, Oregon. I have a company called P&E Distributing Company that's located in Baker City, Oregon. I service a tri-county market area. The counties are Baker, Union, and Wallowa County, which are rural eastern Oregon counties, I'm sure you're aware. It's a family business. My two sons plus my wife are involved in the business. We have 14 employees, including my family members, so we have 10 other employees. We pay a family wage job. We provide benefits. We're involved in the community, and we like to do business in eastern Oregon and have, like I say, for 42 years now. I bought the business with my uncle 42 years ago. He retired. I bought him out, and I've carried it on, and my sons have entered the business also. Excuse me. We support all local events, fundraisers, any kind of activity with the schools. We especially like to be involved with children, do a lot of the little league programs and volleyball and everything. So we feel we're an active member in the community. I feel this bill would really put a hardship on our small business. They're forcing a small business to join a larger co-op that we feel does a great job in the market areas it's in. We don't feel that there is anything needs to be changed there. We don't feel there's anything needs to be changed in our rural markets either. We've been performing this recycling project, we call it, since 1971 when the bottle bill passed. I was in business at that time. We actually dealt with deposits prior to that, since we also handled soft drinks, which had a deposit on the bottle, so the bottle could come back to go to the bottler to be washed and reclaimed at that time and refilled. So it was a big change for us because there was more products involved other than just the glass. We service all of our accounts on a regular basis. We do all the reclaim on a regular basis. Larger accounts, 2 to 3 times per week. Small accounts in the outlying areas on a weekly basis. We're a pre-sale company because we handle beer, wine, and soft drinks. Our drivers are responsible for merchandising, delivery, and the pickup of refuge products. The refuge products we then recycle. We've recycled those products since the inception of the bottle bill for 39 years. Nothing's really changed, even with the added products of additional bottles, the flavored waters. We haven't seen a big change. The volume in our rural markets is not as overwhelming as it is in the metro markets, so it hasn't been anything that we couldn't adapt to and handle in a very efficient method. There's 3 locations in eastern Oregon, I don't think that's been touched on, that do recycling, that are part of some of the other distributors that I'm with today. Ontario has 2 recycling locations in distributor facilities. LeGrand has one, and there's one in Pendleton. So we have the ability in the rural areas to take care of all the materials there without having a larger carbon footprint, a lot of transportation costs because of the local and use of the facilities, and also it helps some of the employment in these smaller areas by using the local facilities. I was interested when Mr. Gilliam with Northwest Grocers talked about the backroom problems. We've never seen that. We don't have a lot of large stores, but we do have approximately 7 major chains in our market. Reverse Bend has been around for, 13 years? We just don't see it. We didn't see it before. We don't see it now. So I'm not as sure what he's alluding to. Any store 5,000 square feet or larger has to redeem all containers, as I'm sure you're very aware. Those that are smaller do not. So they just redeem what they sell. So, they don't have such a variety to come back. There's usually 4 to 5 distributors that service those companies and those stores. And like I say, they take care of their own products, and we don't seem to see that kind of backroom problems when we have 2 to 3 day a week delivery schedules. I think our company is like a lot of the other companies that have testified today. We would like to be part of the solution, not part of a problem. And we have tried to come up with some resolution with OBRC, try to mediate with them a little bit to that end. At this point, we've not been successful. I still think that's a viable option with a third party involved, that possibly we could come up with an agreement that would work for all of us for that market area. And I think it's been reiterated before, there are currently 65 members in OBRC of either manufacturer, bottler, or distributor. And there are 41 non-members currently in the state of Oregon. So, you know, OBRC certainly has a majority, but based on the information that we've received, there are certainly a lot of other distributors, bottlers, or manufacturers that are not involved at this time. That's about all I have to add. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to ask those.
I'll go with Paul first. And
okay.
Yeah, any questions? No, Paul.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland. I'm also in a family business. I work for my daughter, who's employed by me, or I'm employed by her, depending on the day. Seriously, on this particular bill, you have before you a number of distributors who are great people. They've been doing the job with the bottle bill forever, ever since it came in. They made it work. The grocers made it work. You changed the bottle bill in 2007, and we had a commitment to you that we would put together some kind of operation that allowed you to do not only expand it, but to do universal redemption. And that's the problem, universal redemption. Because that can or bottle that used to go only to the store that sold it now goes any place where that particular kind of beverage is sold. So somebody in one part of the state has to be able to go to someplace else in the other part of the state and get that container back. So the nickel gets whole. Now you could do that. The easiest way to do it, and I'll probably regret ever saying this, is have DEQ collect all nickels and DEQ run redemption centers and DEQ, in effect, pass out everything and keep whatever's left over if there's anything left over. It's also probably the most expensive way to do it. But it will work because they are universal. The problem we were faced with in the beverage industry is how do you make it work when you don't have government involvement? Because the bottle bill has worked, frankly, because there has been no government involvement in it. We, the industry, made it work. We screamed and yelled and bitched and moaned for 10 years, and then we said, forget it, we're going to just make it work. And that's what we're doing with OBRC and with any other co-op, frankly, because the bill before you does not preclude any other co-op. It just requires that any co-op that's out there service a majority of the dealers or grocers in the state. That's all. And that's part of universal redemption. You have to be able to go every place to pick up the stuff, otherwise you're worthless. Now, within a given territory, everybody who's spoken here today does a wonderful job. They're great, absolutely great. But that's the old model. That's what we're dealing with. We're trying to transition now. So what you need with this new bill is to put in the incentive, basically, for everybody to cooperatively work together, get stuff done. Everybody has their own myths and facts about what the cost structure is with the OBRC. I can pretty much guarantee you that a good portion of what came out today as far as costs were costs and not the plus side. For example, it doesn't make sense to have two different entities going to a store in Eastern Oregon or frankly any place. And what does make most sense is to contract with a local distributor who might be going there already for all of the containers, including the ones that particular person doesn't pick up. So it probably makes much more sense to actually pay a distributor to go and get it, and that's what OBRC, I believe, was in the negotiations to do, pay somebody to go actually go out and do the stuff. Those are all negotiations within OBRC. OBRC is a cooperative organization. It cannot treat one group different than another group. It can't do that. The laws of the state ban that. So all we're saying is we need this bill to move forward. Everybody will get together, work out. We're still working out. I know OBRC is still working out the cost structure, changing it regularly when they find out different things in the marketplace, because it's new to everybody. But the old system can't work. The new system has to work, otherwise we're doomed to failure. Thank you.
Any further questions? That's all the testimony. I want to thank everybody for their testimony. Right now I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3704. I have had a couple requests, and I am going to entertain the fact that we will move a work session for tomorrow at 2:30. And that's when the work session on this bill will happen. One person asked if they could talk one more time to somebody on the committee. I said that's fine, we'll work that. But tomorrow there will be a work session on House Bill 3704 at 2:30. So we'll move that to that. And now we need to open a public hearing on 3706. We'll have a short explanation. Do you want to go through that?
Are you talking to me? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3704 allows two or more beverage distributors.
3706.
My apologies, members. House Bill 3706.
Sing that song already.
House Bill 3706 includes loans and extensions of credit in the definition of real estate goods or services for purposes of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, declares an emergency. It's effective on passage. Members also have -1 amendments distributed to them, which adds mortgage bankers, mortgage brokers, loan originators, pawnbrokers, and persons prohibited from making certain consumer loans in the course of business without a license to the definition of state-regulated lender. It also narrows the scope of conduct by state-regulated lenders to be acted on by the Department of Justice at the request of DCBS to that involving loans or extensions of credit.
Okay, thank you. Okay. We had an informational meeting last week when this bill was given to us, and so we got some information. I think those people will be back to give us some more information. But right now, I will take the rule of the group who has signed up, and we'll start out with Angela Martin and Todd McCartney.
Thank you. Chair Roebling, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Angela Martin, representing Our Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3706. Enforceable protection for consumers is critical, whether the wrongdoer is a person, an appliance dealer, or a bank. In most states, that enforceable protection is offered through the State Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Obviously, the question before you today is whether that general consumer protection law in Oregon should also apply to business transactions that involve credit. This has been a long-standing goal for consumer advocates. Since the beginning of housing crisis, consumer advocates have been working for accountability and enforcement applied to all lenders who engage in predatory lending practices. In the past and today, groups like AARP and Osberg have joined with us to see that this is an important step in protecting home ownership. In 2005, then Attorney General Hardy Myers brought forward a similar bill before this body, and pointing this out to show that this has been, again, a long-standing goal for consumer advocates. Every state has consumer protection statutes prohibiting unfair and deceptive trade practices. Okay. By excluding loans from the UTPA, Oregon stands with a minority of states. In the testimony I handed in, I included a handout that shows you 27 states, including Washington and California, have UTPA coverage for credit transactions. Opponents of this bill will proclaim that the lenders they represent are highly regulated. However, from the perspective of a consumer who has no recourse to seek a remedy against the lender who misled them about the terms of their loan or added fees and interest that were not earned, regulation without enforceable protection for the individual is hardly worth the paper it's written on. That's certainly the case for consumers like Renee Maxwell, who joined me last week to testify in support of this concept. She has been working to remove $2,000 in unearned interest from her credit card account. It's also the case for people like Ira Cheatham, who I've been working with since 2005. Back in 2001, he received a loan filled with abusive terms and exorbitant fees that was contrary to the promises made by his lender that his loan would reduce his monthly payments. That lender was Wells Fargo. So where are the state laws for borrowers like the Cheathams? As we heard in the informational hearing last Friday, due to federal preemption rules, which were expanded under the previous administration, federally insured lenders are exempt from state mortgage lending laws. In the majority of states, the 27 states on that list, this imbalance is partly corrected through the UTPA law. This is, again, not true in Oregon, where court rulings have effectively excluded loans from the UTPA definition of goods and services. As a result, the Oregon borrower who is the victim of predatory lending has a much better chance of recovering damages if the state-licensed lender issued the loan. This consumer, of course, has no way of understanding the double standard until it is too late. The exclusion of creditors from the UTPA also puts Oregon homeowners at a disadvantage when it comes to addressing the foreclosure crisis. Large-scale efforts to modify loans are necessary to help stem the tide of foreclosures and stabilize our economy. However, thus far, major lenders have not participated to the degree necessary. We see federal lawmakers have passed laws filled with incentives aimed at encouraging compliance. State lawmakers have passed funding mechanisms to increase assistance to homeowners through free foreclosure counselors. But the fact remains that the common experience for homeowners is one of frustration, inaction, misinformation, and ultimately too often foreclosures. In response, state AGs are, across the country are considering legal action aimed at fixing this problem. However, without 3706, Oregon's chief law enforcement officer does not have the authority necessary to join with those other attorney generals in pursuing this type of action. In responding to assertions that such legislation as the bill before you would open the door to frivolous and unwarranted lawsuits, one need only look at the strength of attorney sanctions and attorney fee fines that could be levied on plaintiffs of frivolous cases. These very protections guide the operations of every other business that operate under the UTPA, and these safeguards would also protect lenders. In closing, I just want to say again, I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 3706. We believe it will correct an unfair patchwork of protections and extend consumer protection for some of our most important consumer transactions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Todd McCartney. Thank you guys for your time today, and I'll try to be as brief as I can. I entered into a loan agreements with Wells Fargo for the purchase of a riverfront property in Yamhill County on the 6th of June 2006. After purchasing it, it became apparent that the existing structure was insufficient and would need to be torn down. I arranged for a new construction loan and then donated the structure to the local fire department for training purposes. After the structure was burned down by the fire department, I learned that my construction loan had fallen through. Faced with high payments on what was now vacant land, I approached Wells Fargo for a loan modification. I was told that unless I missed payments on my mortgage, that I would not qualify for the loan modification programs. Therefore, at the direction of Wells Fargo, I did not make any more payments on the loan. After missing payments, I contacted Wells Fargo to start the loan modification process. 8 months later and 26 phone calls later, I finally was told that because I missed the payments for the loan and other reasons they would not disclose to me, I no longer qualified for any loan modification programs. With the loan modification off the table, I was told that a short sale was an option. I hired a new realtor because I had the property listed after I couldn't get the loan to build my new home. I hired a realtor and an attorney to work on it. We received an offer from the property and submitted documents to Wells Fargo and were finally assigned a negotiator, which was Jeffrey Schwartz. Wells decided that they would approve the short sale, but only if I accepted a deficiency judgment for the portion of the loan that was not covered by the short sale. Otherwise, they would foreclose on the property. My understanding that a lender cannot collect a deficiency judgment in Oregon after foreclosing a residential loan. When I would not accept the deficiency judgment, my file was deactivated. I was told when I was ready to accept the deficiency judgment, the short sale would go through. My attorney kept in contact with Wells Fargo in hopes that the short sale could be completed. On January 6, 2010, my attorney received an internal email from Wells Fargo that was meant for someone else in Wells Fargo. Controlled burn guy. Any thoughts? We didn't want this guy to get away with it. I would just assume let him hang. Right after they had sent that email, the very next day, I received an approval on my short sale. We reached tentative agreement on the primary part of the short sale, but the saga continues because they introduced new roadblocks that will require me to recreate all of the work we have done and submitting all the paperwork all over again. On top of this, we received a notice of a default and election to sell the property. The auction date is for February 22, 2010. Although we have been told by others within Wells Fargo, the auction date is not until April of 2010. This has been one of the most maddening experiences of my life. Each step of the way, I have worked in good faith with Wells Fargo. I have done all that has been asked of me. I do not think there is any reasonable doubt that Wells Fargo has operated in bad faith as far as my case is concerned. It is my sincere hope that this body can take some action which will require large national lenders such as Wells Fargo to conduct their business in good faith. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for either of these witnesses? Thanks. Representative Holby. I just got here. I would have had you up before.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Paul Holvey, State Representative, District 8. I come to you today in support of this bill, and I wanted to give you just a little bit of background with my involvement in this bill. We did have this issue in the Consumer Protection Committee just last week, and we were unable to rectify all the amendments in this bill and to move it out. This bill, as you previously heard, really is about protecting consumers in Oregon who currently do not have any protection. This bill is restricted to just loans and extensions of credit and adding them to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. It provides, as I said, protections that currently don't exist for consumers against many lenders of credit. One of the pieces of this bill that we worked on was trying to figure out how to separate out the regulatory authority that is currently under Department of Consumer and Business Services and for UTP action under the Attorney General's office. It was something that we finally came to an agreement with both DCBS and the Attorney General's office with the -1 amendment to this bill. It makes sure that we don't have dual regulatory authority. It leaves the enforcement and regulatory authority with the Department of Consumer and Business Services for all the entities that it currently regulates. It gives authority to take UTPA action by the Attorney General for conduct of lenders that are not currently regulated by DCBS, such as those that are federally chartered and were preempted from taking any action currently in our statutes under our regulatory authority. This bill gives the AG the ability to take that action against lenders, and it also, as you've heard, gives the Attorney General's office the ability to enjoin with multi-state actions. The Attorney General may not take any action against the conduct or practices of lenders that are regulated by DCBS unless requested to do so by DCBS. The Attorney General may also not make rules under this provision for lenders without the approval of DCBS for those lenders that it already regulates. The bill does provide a private right of action for consumers with attorney fees for prevailing parties. And this is an important piece for private citizens to be able to take action. Currently, under regulatory framework, it's very difficult for private citizens to sue. Though they can sue, they have to pay for their own attorney fees, and very difficult for an individual to succeed in years, perhaps, of litigation. They simply can't afford to take on that kind of risk in paying those fees for litigation that could go on for a long time. This is about fairness for consumers being able to protect themselves, and for the state of Oregon to help protect those consumers in these sorts of situations with lenders that we currently aren't able to regulate. I think it's been pointed out that many other states also include lenders in their state trade practices, and certainly a lot of industries in the state of Oregon are already under the Unfair Trade Practices Act and seem to be able to continue to do business. I have no doubt that the lending industry will continue to thrive in Oregon should this bill pass, and the good part will be that we'll have a good level playing field of lenders treating consumers in a fair and just way. I really believe that this is a bill that deserves consideration and is extremely important to pass, as we have seen the mortgage and foreclosure markets really fraught with a lot of problems right now. I think it's extremely important the state of Oregon steps in and puts some laws behind the consumers for Oregon to enable them to stay protected from deceptive practices. I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for this witness? Okay.
Representative Berger.
The hour is late, and I don't want to belabor this, and you may not be the one to answer this, but the gentleman that spoke before you and his issues with his lender, where in this bill would he enter in with the private right of action piece? Is that where?
Well, certainly I know the Attorney General's office is in the room and probably could answer that question as long as DCBS, but I imagine they could probably pursue a private right of action, or the Attorney General may actually take action as well in that particular case if this bill were in place.
Okay, thank you.
And we can check that later. Thank you. Next, we will have Steve Emery, Tim Martinez, and Ken Sherman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve Emery. I've been a senior mortgage banker and in the mortgage business for 20 years. I've owned my own company. I've been a loan officer, mortgage broker, mortgage banker. I chaired the Ethics Committee for the Mortgage Brokers Association from 99 to 2003. I participated in the the Governor's Mortgage Lending Work Group in 07 and 08 with some of the legislation that was done in 08 and 09. I'm against this. My main point is when is enough enough? I think a lot of people that are speaking in support of this are fighting a battle from 2-3 years ago, and we're not in Kansas anymore. Industry abuses in the past, obviously in 03, 07, anyone that could fog a mirror could be a loan officer. That was a big problem. We had 1D, Division of Finance and Corporate Security Examiner, which is under DCBS, and hardly any regulatory efforts on a federal level. There was no liability hardly for loan officers. Things could not be more different today. Oregon legislatures are reasonable, so I'm just assuming that you must not be aware of all the recent related mortgage history and how much has changed. Laws have changed, barriers to entry have changed, liabilities have changed. To me personally, I'm just a loan officer now. I no longer own any companies or anything. Briefly, sweeping federal changes, some of the largest in 30 years. Truth in Lending Act has had some of the biggest changes in over 30 years. The RESPA, which is the other major one of two federal regulatory acts, has major changes in since, I think, 16 years. These things were discussed in 07, passed in 08, took effect in 09 and 2010. And some of the new federal laws are taking effect in 2010. These things are coming into play, and they're huge. The Federal Reserve also has additional compensation changes that have passed through the rules-making process in the last 30 days, and they're about to be put into place. Huge changes. There are thousands of new federal regulators, HUD, probably tens of thousands. HUD has hired tens of, you know, two or 3,000 people. IRS has hired a bunch. The feds have hired a bunch. A whole bunch more people enforcing the mortgage industry. Now, how about Oregon? Oregon has passed, in my opinion, the most sweeping changes to mortgage regulation since it enacted its law in 94. And maybe the reason Oregon didn't put us in the UTPA was because we have had licensing since 94. Many states did not. In fact, many states didn't have any mortgage licensing for their people until 2007, if you believe it. So we passed it a long time ago. So maybe they felt with our regulation we didn't need to be in UTPA. Anyway, the Oregon changes, which is House Bill 2189, which amends ORS 59 substantially, which I think is now 86, anyway, all these numbers and acronyms. Anyway, this was all discussed back in 07 and 08. It was passed in 09, and it takes effect this July 31st, 2010. As a loan officer, I am now federally licensed, state licensed. I'm covered by bonds, and there's high standards. I'm liable for restitution by order of the director.
Thank you.
$25,000 fines, private rights of action that are new for individuals with this new thing. So, yeah, there's limits on it. It has to be to ascertainable losses and some other little things. It's not as wide open as UTPA, thank God. But anyway, I am open to private rights of action and class C felonies. This is all brand new coming up in about 4 or 5 months. Mortgage industries, or the mortgage companies, also have all that. Additionally, they have much higher bonding requirements, which I support. I was trying to get those raised 5 years ago, and higher fines. Oregon now has many more examiners at the division, a lot more, and I'm okay with having much more. And there's less of us to watch. And here's the best part about all this. People say thrive. Well, the mortgage industry, if you go back and look, about three, 4 years ago, there was 13,000 people like me in this state doing mortgage loans. Today, there are 4,400. I pulled that number today off of the state's website. 4,436, I believe. That's horrible. We've lost two-thirds of the people in this industry. Now, as being one of the survivors, I actually kind of like that. But there's a lot more people regulating us and a lot less people. So I think we can catch the bad players a lot better these days. And another thing, I've talked to a few people that work at DF, Division of Finance, Corporate and Securities, and they are thinking that with some of these new liabilities that we have to pass, and I'll tell you about them briefly, that maybe as much as 2,000 of the 4,400 left will not pass the licensing requirements July 31st. I know I will, but this is horrible. I mean, our industry is collapsing. Is the point. Mortgage brokers did about 70% of the loans if you go back 7, 8, 10 years ago. Last year they did 15%. The predictions on a national level is we're going to do less than 5%, which is why I closed my mortgage company 2 years ago and fired 4 people and went to work for another mortgage bank in Lake Oswego. It wasn't economically feasible for me to keep my doors open, and mainly from the liability. That was the biggest things I was scared of. Some of the new standards will not let this problem happen again. Loan officers could be a hairdresser one day, not to pick on hairdressers, but you could be a hairdresser one day and a loan officer the next. You could be a part-time loan officer while you still did your other job. It can't be done these days. The new Federal SAFE Act, which was passed and done back in like 08, took effect in 08, and that's what's making this new Oregon law take effect. That's massively changes that takes effect on July 31st this year. Basically, has really hard tests. You have to take national tests. You have to take individual state tests. There are education requirements before you can take the test. There are education requirements after you take the test every year. There are credit requirements. We have members in our association that have possibly bankruptcies or foreclosures. They're afraid they're not going to get their keep their license, and maybe they shouldn't. I mean, that was the intent of this bill. I'm not going to argue that today, but that is what's happening. If you have judgments, problems on your credit, the state of Oregon and the Mortgage Lending Work Group decided to implement the SAFE Act, which is a federal law, quite strictly. Many states did not do it as strictly. Washington did not do it as strictly. Oregon's done it much more strictly. We have tighter background checks and more. All I ask is that we please let the dust settle on things that were passed and written about 2 years ago, a year ago, that are taking effect now and in the next 6 months. Let's let the dust settle on this stuff and see if there's even an industry left in Oregon in a year or two. Because do we want all of our Oregon citizens to go to work, or, well, number one, go to work for the federal banks, because then I can avoid most of this stuff and also take a major pay cut. But nobody cares about me. But basically, what will happen when all of our Oregon consumers don't have Oregon banks and credit unions and mortgage bankers to go to get their loans? You want them to go to Wells Fargo and Chase, who now control close to six, and Bank of America, who now control close to 60% of the market nationally? And, you know, if you think they're great players, why'd they take all that TARP money to stay in business? I think Oregonians should mainly go to Oregon companies. So I'd ask you just to let the dust settle and let's not add new problems and liabilities.
Thank you.
I'm done.
Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I was about to get my pom-poms out and go rah-rah, but then his last couple sentences kind of made me pause. So I agree with most of what Mr. Emery had to say. I'd also let the committee know that I'm here also on behalf of the United Financial Lobby, which is the mortgage brokers, mortgage bankers, banks, credit unions, consumer finance folks. And everybody will be surprised that we're opposed to this bill, but we are. And I will be brief because the hour's late. I'm going to let Mr. Sherman do most of the testimony for us. But I would just like to make 2 points. I think it was in this very hearing room, either last session or in 2007, when we stood up with the Department of Consumer and Business Services and asked to pay more so that we could get more examiners for our banks. And we did that because we wanted to make sure, A, there were quality folks examining. They had some openings. They wanted to do some expansion. And we didn't say, okay, we'll support this, but only if you look at this particular activity. We don't want you looking at consumer protection or any of that. We did not say that. We said, you need more examiners. We agree with you. We want to stand shoulder to shoulder with you and help you get those examiners. And you indeed, as a body, did pass additional spending authority so that they could hire new examiners, and those folks are now, as far as I know, hired and hard at work. The second thing I would say is I've had a chance over the last 7 years to listen to Ms. Streisinger testify several times before different committees. And one of the things that seems to be missing in this hearing, and or at least on Friday and before Chair Holby's committee, is this whole notion of the dual charter system. And we have a dual charter system for a reason. You have state chartered banks and federal chartered banks, and there's a reason for that. And I will be providing, I won't go into it today, again, the hour is late, but I will provide all the members of the committee a report written a few years ago talking about the benefits. I would just say that there's a reason banks choose where they're chartered, and we ought to respect that. And there is certainly numerous regulations and statutes that Ken's going to talk about that apply to federal banks that are operating in this state. So I would just stop there.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sherman. I'm counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. House Bill 3706 would reverse about 45 years of settled Oregon law by making the UTPA applicable to loans and extensions of credit. And I think you have to ask, as a starting point, why are we changing this after all of that time? And why has it always been this way? Well, I think it's been this way, and I think the courts in Oregon have said that the UTPA doesn't apply because the legislature has said UTPA doesn't apply to loans and extensions of credit, and they have said that because of the fact that lenders are uniquely regulated by both state and federal law and regulation across the country. So why, after all these years of this settled law, are we now moving in the course of this special session, which I've always thought of special sessions as designed to kind of tinker with the budget and take care of emergency problems and get out of Dodge? What is the emergency rush to judgment with respect to this bill? It was before the legislature back in, 2005, and this body in its wisdom elected not to enact that legislation at that time. I haven't gone back and read the legislative history of why that didn't occur, but I think it's fair to say that, again, there was some consideration given to the fact that Lenders are, after all, subject to an entire, a very thorough, very complete body of regulatory law. The representatives of the Department of Justice and DCBS that spoke to you at your informational meeting last week gave the impression that somehow with all of these rules that we already have, that consumers, and particularly consumers who patronize national banks, are simply not protected and they have no recourse. And there was some suggestion of that yet today. But if you do the research and look at the rules that now apply to lenders, it is really stunning. And I actually attached, I think it's about 3 pages of the various regulations. This is a very incomplete list. It's not in any way supposed to be comprehensive. But things like the Consumer Credit Protection Act, consumer credit, we're talking about protecting consumers, the Electronic Funds Transfers Act, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, the Fair or the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act that someone else mentioned, and of course the Truth in Lending Act, which is kind of the granddaddy with its Regulation Z, the whole purpose of which, and it's existed since what, 1965, whole purpose is to provide effective protection through law and regulation for consumers of financial services. And of course, Oregon's not been asleep at the switch. We've got a very healthy suitcase full of state law and regulation that protect the consumers as well. But somehow it's been suggested that the poor consumer just has no where to go, no protection really involved there. But you look at these, and I just cited a few examples that I'll go through very quickly in my testimony. The Electronic Funds Transfer Act provides for individual and class actions for damages, with damages being the greater of actual damages or a minimum of $100,000 in an individual action, or $500,000 or 1% of net worth in the case of a class action. And that's, of course, in addition to an award of your costs and attorney fees. Under Truth in Lending, similar rights, individual or class actions, the greater of actual damages or statutory minimums that range up to $4,000 in individual cases, and again, $500,000 or 1% of net worth, plus costs and attorney fees, all to be recorded or recovered by the consumer who is wronged. Same is true under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, looking at a different area of activity, but the same kinds of self-help action available to the consumer. More of the same under Equal Credit Opportunity, with the added attraction of punitive damages up to $10,000. And that's also true under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, actual damages plus punitive damages plus costs and attorney fees. And one other point that I think is really important to bear in mind, particularly in view of the testimony you heard earlier, that the consumer really can't afford to use these remedies because they have to pay their own attorney fees. Well, in each and every one of those statutes that I've cited, if the consumer sues and the consumer wins, the consumer recovers his attorney fees and his costs. It comes out of the defendant's pocket. But does that work in reverse? Does if the defendant, if the lender prevails and is able to show that the consumer's claim is without merit, does the lender get to recover attorney fees and costs? Not unless you can convince the judge that the case was brought without any merit. And in my experience as 35 years as a lawyer, I've very rarely seen that happen. So it's really not a level playing field in regard to the exercise of those rights. Let me just close, and I know you've got other things to do this evening and want to get through with this as quickly as possible, but I think you have to look at this very carefully. The fact is that UTPA has grown like Topsy over the year. It started with maybe a half a dozen or a dozen of specific things that you couldn't do under the UTPA, and that list is now up to, I think it's 62 subsections, some of which refer to multiple wrongs. So the total number of no-nos that are covered by the UTPA and Oregon law today are in excess of 100 different things. And so we're layering on that incredible additional burden, some of which, of course, have no relationship to lending activities, but many of them will. And some of them, if you look at them, I think there are some potential for unintended consequences. For example, if you look at ORS 646-607, that makes it an unlawful trade practice to employ any unconscionable tactic. And you look at that and you say, well, gee, that makes sense. Nobody wants to let people get away with that. But then you have to look at the definition of unconscionable tactic. And one of the, I think there are three or four ways that you can get in trouble there is if you permit, and I'm quoting the statute now, a customer to enter into a transaction with knowledge that there is no reasonable probability of payment of the attendant financial obligation in full by the customer when due. So that statute, if applied to lending and extensions of credits by lenders, would basically say that you've got to do some sort of a wallet biopsy on the borrower. And remember, you know, we're not just talking about mortgage loans here. We're talking about every loan and every extension of credit. Every time you use your credit card, that's an extension of credit. So is the financial institution, or it's not limited to financial institution, what about the department store? Is the department store supposed to stand there and figure out whether there's anything about this transaction that suggests to them that they know or should know that you might not be able to pay this bill? Because if they can show, if the consumer can show that, then not only do they not have to repay the claim, you've engaged in this unconscionable tactic, and they can sue you for damages and so forth. So that's kind of tough, and it's made tougher by the fact that we've got some laws coming at us from the other side. We've got things like the Community Reinvestment Act, which was passed by Congress back in the 70s, which basically penalizes lenders for not being aggressive in extending credit to everyone within their service area. It's a perfectly good law, and it's after a laudable cause. But we've got other things like the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, which again says you need to extend credit without discriminating on a prohibited basis against anyone in your service area. Well, that's a good law too, but you put those kinds of things that are saying extend credit up against the statute which says you better be sure this person can repay, and you put the bank or the lender, whoever it may be, on a really tough tightrope. And I think that's something that ought to be given a lot of consideration. One of the thoughts that occurred to me, I'm on the board of the local hospital, and you know, we do a lot of charity care, or care for which we don't get paid over there. Doctors do too. What about the physician who says to his or her patient, you know, you need this treatment? If the doctor provides that care and accepts a credit card or just says pay me 6 months from now, and knows or should know that that customer is probably not going to be able to pay that bill, that's an unconscionable tactic. If you extend this bill to apply to loans and extensions of credit. So I just think that it bears taking some careful time to think through all of the 100-plus things that we're now imposing on extenders of credit, be they banks or physicians. And there's no rush to judgment. There's no reason why you need to do this in this special session. We were not even invited to the table to participate in the discussions on this. And it seems to me that if you're really serious about that, in this, and you really feel there's a gap, it makes some sense to get some people that are in the business of extending credit to sit down with you at the table to look at those problems. Thank you very much for your attention. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions for this panel? Representative Burke.
Just a quick one from Mr. Emery. What's your opinion on you having to come back and defeat or to argue against the same bill within a week?
Well, not happy about that. No. Some of these things, in my opinion, it seems like some of the stuff that I come down and argue, and I'm not an attorney, I'm a loan officer, so it seems like some of the things I come down and argue against, I've argued against some of the same things over and over again, and the same stories come up here on the opposing side over and over again, and a lot of times what I see is the solutions that are being proposed actually don't even address the stories that are being told. But, I'm not fond of, if you're asking my opinion to come back repeatedly on the same thing, no, don't like it. But isn't that our process? I don't know.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One more question.
Mr. Sherman.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Mr. Sherman.
Yes.
Did I hear you correctly suggest or state that the individual companies, banks, and organizations that you represent aren't in the habit of doing due diligence before they extend credit? And how do they justify that before their credit policy committees if they don't do due diligence and assure themselves and their investors that the customer can in fact pay the loan back?
Chair Roblin, Representative Nolan, I don't think I said anything along those lines. I'm not sure what part of my testimony you were referring to, but no, I did not mean to imply that, at least in the ideal, that our clients, our customer, our members of our association do not do due diligence in making loans. They certainly attempt to do that.
Okay, that's what I would have expected, but I thought I heard you say that it seemed unreasonable to expect that someone would do a creditworthiness evaluation before extending credit.
Chair Roblin, Representative Nolan, again, extension of credit means many things in our modern world, and the one I was focusing on there is the situation where I give you a credit card and turn you loose, and I don't have an effective way to police, and I don't think I should have a way to police every time you use that card and by doing so obtain an extension of credit.
I don't have too many credit cards in my wallet, but I do have a couple, and both of them have credit limits on them based on my credit worthiness. Is that not standard practice?
No, Chair Roblin and Representative Nolan, I believe it is standard practice.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you all. We have two more panels, so we'll try to keep it as close as I've been trying to get as much time as we possibly can have. So, Paul Romaine, Paul Cosgrove, and Jim Marquis. We're going to try to get this last one in after this one, so as quickly as you can, I would appreciate it.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm here representing the Oregon Pawnbrokers Association. And just to pick up on the line of questioning of the last witness, the pawnbroking business is probably the original lender, or the ones who, when you brought in the sheep, we held the sheep and then we gave you the money, and then you came back and got the sheep and we gave you, you paid off the loan, and that's how it worked. Frankly, if you're taking in an item like a gun or a tool or something like that as collateral, you don't really look at the creditworthiness of the person borrowing. They may not be able to repay that loan. But your concern isn't that they're not going to repay the loan. Your concern is that that item that they're giving to you as collateral be of sufficient value so that you can, in effect, get the loan repaid by selling that if they don't come in. So that's why things in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act really don't apply to a pawnbroker. And an unconscionable tactic of, in effect, making a loan where the chance of repayment is really not that great may not be something that a pawnbroker would consider because we don't know their credit history. We know the value of the item that they have. So that's why, from the pawnbroker perspective, lumping everybody into the Unlawful Trade Practices Act really doesn't work. What I heard earlier today were reasons for getting federal banks under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, but what you have here is a shotgun blast that gets a lot of people that you really don't want to get in. Let me back up a little bit, a little of my history. You all know me as the lobbyist for various interest groups around here. But a couple of things. First of all, I was in the Legislative Council office in 1975, and I actually am the one who drafted the anti-deficiency law that's in Oregon today. It was actually my idea to a legislator to put it in there. Number two is, from 1977, or actually January 1977 until July of 1977, I was the head of the Consumer Protection Division of the Department of Justice. I enforced the Unlawful Trade Practices Act on behalf of the Department of Justice here, and then I became the Chief Deputy Attorney General under Attorney General Jim Redden. So I'm intimately familiar with the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. It's very interesting that from a pawnbroker's perspective, and probably from most people's perspective, we don't really care that much about the Attorney General's involvement. That's not the huge concern. You, in your amendment, your proposed amendment, you've sort of even put a brake on that, where they have to consult with DCBS before they get involved. That's all well and good, but you're forgetting the 800-pound gorilla in the room, which is the private right of action. That's the thing that is frightful to anybody out there. Because under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, there's a minimum amount of damages. It's statutory minimum of $200. There is our attorney fees, and the standard for giving to a prevailing plaintiff is totally different than a prevailing defendant. There's also the possibility of getting punitive damages. And in fact, a prevailing defendant can get attorney fees, but it's very rare, believe me, when you can actually prove that the action was totally frivolous. But the interesting thing is, if it's brought as a class action, you're precluded as a defendant from getting attorney fees, even if the class action really doesn't have a lot of merit. So you're in a, that's why you fear that particular act. What we're saying is, we have no objection to having the Attorney General involved. I remember the thought process we used to go through on, did we go after a car dealer or somebody else who was out there? And there was a lot of thought that went into it, and I'm sure that in the current Attorney General's office, they go through the same thing. What you do fear, and what you've not put any brake on, is what the private plaintiff will do. And the problem with that is, once you file a lawsuit, then I'm faced as a defendant with a choice. Do I defend that lawsuit, or do I try and settle? And what I'm looking at is, if I simply give it to my attorney to open up a file, it's probably going to cost me $1,000 to $1,500 bucks, maybe more, because that's what attorneys charge. So it's cheaper for me to basically pay you off, which is what I'll do. I'll pay you off. I'll give you a couple hundred bucks. I'll give you $500. I'll give you $1,000. It's cheaper for me to operate that way than it is for me to actually defend. So unless you're willing to put some kind of break in there on the private right of action, not just the Attorney General. In fact, your break on the Attorney General, frankly, doesn't make a lot of sense. But unless you're trying to put a break on the private right of action, we would really appreciate it if you took the pawnbrokers out. We don't belong in this law. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Cosgrove representing Oregon Financial Services Association. And if you look on the Dash 1 amendment on line 3, it says a person that is required to be licensed under ORS Chapter 725-045, that's my members. We are consumer finance companies. We've not been around as long as pawnbrokers, but I can tell you our association was formed in the 30s, and some of our members were family-owned businesses that were in business before that. So we are actually also a longtime member of the community here in Oregon. You've heard from others about all the new federal requirements. Mr. Emery, I think, did a good job of discussing those in the context of mortgages. We are under a comprehensive state licensing statute. You have not, as a body, in this session or in other sessions in for history, been hesitant to change those licensing statutes as you have felt necessary in order to prevent abuses. We are under rate caps and fee caps and lots of restrictions on what we can and cannot do, and we have lots of ways in which both the state, through Ms. Streisinger's department, Department of Consumer and Business Services, and in many cases directly from consumers with private rights of action, can be attacked if we don't do things correctly. And that's our concern about this bill. It's not that there's any federal preemption with respect to us. We have a state comprehensive state licensing and regulatory statute with a whole overlay of federal laws as well. And many of those have private rights of action, as Mr. Sherman had mentioned, in which consumers, if they're successful, can get their attorney's fees paid. So in, for those reasons, we believe that this is not only unnecessary but harmful to a long-standing industry that has acted well, that it has fulfilled its obligations under licensing statutes. And when we have erred, individually or collectively, we've been brought to task either by you, who have the ability to tell us what we can and cannot do, or by individual attorneys representing consumers. It's not been our experience that there's a lack of ability to enforce good practices on us. In fact, quite the contrary. So for that reason, we oppose the bill. I would suggest, in agreement with Mr. Romaine, which is difficult because we almost always disagree on things, for me to say this in a public meeting, we also believe that the break on the Attorney General is helpful. That's where I may disagree with him on his characterization of that. But the real concern is the private right of action with respect to us. In most of the cases where the private right of action exists for us, with respect to disclosure of things like our interest rates, if we make a mathematical error, and if we can show that we have done that, but we've had bona fide procedures in place to take care of that, and this was a bona fide error, we have a defense under an Unlawful Trade Practices Act. Even those kinds of minor mathematical calculation errors would be subject to significant liabilities. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Markey on behalf of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. God help me, I remember when Paul Romaine was in legislative council.
he was in diapers.
The Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association is the Oregon affiliate of Mortgage Bankers of America. We have members... a wide variety of members, but many of our members are non-depository mortgage banking companies, Pacific Residential Mortgage and several others, and they're licensed under Chapter 86A. It used to be Chapter 59. It was moved by you last session to 86. And under that licensing act, it is a very robust regulatory program run by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Under the Act, there are prohibitions, many prohibitions, including any misleading, fraudulent activity. And then, in addition, the Department of Consumer Business Services has the authority to regulate and has recently adopted rules which will become, well, there are regulatory functions that under their rules whereby they will be regulating those activities that were adopted by Congress under the Federal SAFE Act and others. And the penalties under 86A for those folks licensed there include suspension, or give the Department of Consumer Business Services the authority to suspend or revoke a license, civil penalties for any violation of the Act up to $20,000. Many violations of the Act are a Class C felony, criminal penalties, Class C felony. And that's for fraudulent activity, misleading activity. There are some exclusions under the Act, but they are minimal. And then beyond that, under that Act, there is a right of private action. When, how much is enough? So now we're going to have these folks also regulated under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And what is the danger there? Well, Under the right of private action in 86A, there has to be an ascertainable loss. Attorney fees are available to either party, the prevailing party. And under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, that's simply not the case for either of those items. Additionally, what concerns me is that under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, in a case called Redden versus Discount Fabrics, the Oregon Supreme Court made a ruling that has become common law now, and that is this. The standard of conduct, not common law, but it is used by courts throughout Oregon. The standard of conduct is willful conduct under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And in this case, the Supreme Court said that the term willful means nothing more than not knowing when you should have known. And that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, is ordinary negligence. And so what you subject our clients to by putting them here is a right of private action for making an inadvertent mistake. And I just submit to you that given the regulatory system that's in place, this is a little over the top. And I don't know where all of this goes or how those two laws really come together. They treat, in some cases, the same kinds of things with different words, and I don't think anybody here knows. And I would submit to you that I think it's irresponsible to move this bill forward without knowing the answers to some of these questions. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Our last panel, John Bartholomew, Deborah Heron, and Arthur Towers.
Good evening. Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name, for the record, is John Bartholomew. I'm with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, OSPIRG, and I'll try to keep my remarks very brief. I submitted a lot of written testimony, including some comments from some homeowners that we've been dealing with. And it's those homeowners that is... they're the reason that we're so concerned about supporting this legislation, to give them some recourse for what's happened to them. You all know about the foreclosure situation in our state. There's a new report that just came out last week by RealtyTrack, noted that foreclosures are up 90% in the past year and 303% since 2007 statewide. And the crisis that we're currently in, which is actually not expected to peak until next year, has its roots in questionable lending practices by large national banks. Now, this is impacting a lot of people that we've been talking to, our members. We've been hearing stories from folks. For example, just the other day, a woman, Jennifer Costa in Bend, that I've been talking to, received a loan modification offer from her lender, GMAC. It said on the first page that it would reduce her rate to 2%, yet on the inside it was 5%, and when she called the bank, they said, oh, there's nothing wrong with this. There's a question there, is that incompetence, is it deception? What is it that they're trying to get her to sign? Is it a 2% loan? Is it a 5% loan? There's folks I know that have been told that they've been approved for a loan modification. They made some payments on that loan modification and then told later, 2 months in, that they weren't eligible for a loan modification. So all of these folks that I've been dealing with that have these stories, and like I said, some of them are attached to my written documentation, might have a case under the UTPA of deception or predatory practices. Now, it would be up to an attorney to decide whether or not it was a legitimate case to bring, and an attorney will not bring those cases if they believe it's frivolous because of the, as was mentioned earlier, there are repercussions for bringing frivolous lawsuits, especially when you consider that, you know, homeowners are not going into homeowners facing foreclosure are not looking at getting attorneys, you know, very you know, willy-nilly. They're not going to take that lightly, because they're already behind financially. Now, all of these complaints we have heard from homeowners have been dealing with national lenders like Countrywide, which is now Bank of America, Wells Fargo, GMAC. I actually haven't heard any complaints about Oregon state banks or credit unions. But these national lenders who are responsible for a national foreclosure crisis are unaccountable to Oregonians. While other states like Arizona and Iowa are actually considering lawsuits against these national lenders to hold them responsible for their role in the national crisis, Oregon does have to sit back and watch. I would note that this bill does not punish any business that's operating on the up and up. That it goes after unethical businesses. And if you protect unethical businesses, it puts the ethically operating ones at a disadvantage, which I don't really understand why we would want to do that. I'll sum up by just saying this legislation is simple. It does say that lenders are held to the same standards as anyone else. Walmart, auto repair shops, mobile phone service providers, daycares. These are all companies that are currently operating in the state of Oregon under the UTPA. The UTPA covers lenders in 27 other states, and I don't believe that those states have lost all their banks thus far. So I urge you to include lenders under the UTPA in support of 3706. Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Deborah Herron on behalf of the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition. And in the interest of the late evening hour, I will be very concise with my remarks and just say that the Liability Reform Coalition is very concerned about any legislation that would not improve fairness and balance the scales of justice, particularly civil justice. And expanding the Unlawful Trade Practices Act in this fashion is something that could be very harmful to our Oregon businesses, and I think this is a time where we need to be cautious and careful about how we affect the way that they do business and give our local lenders and banks and insurance agents who were involved in this legislation before it got to Rules Committee the opportunity to be part of this ongoing conversation. And I would ask that you carefully consider the regulations that are already in place before moving this bill forward and taking a little bit more time with this matter, potentially looking at a work group or some other forum for several of the organizations that have been involved in these discussions to be together and come up with some other compromise solution.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Arthur Towers. I'm the political director for Service Employees Union Local 503, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I simply want to put our organization on record in support of this legislation, representing 45,000 workers, predominantly low-wage workers. We're very concerned about issues of economic fairness, both inside and outside the workplace. And again, we simply want to go on record in support of the bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
Representative
Hanna.
Thank you. Mr. Bartholomew, I'm looking at your printed information.
Yes.
When you say that Oregon ended 2009 tallying 34,121 properties with foreclosure filings, my question is detailed. And is there a difference between a filing and an actual foreclosure, or is a filing a foreclosure?
A filing moves towards a foreclosure. It doesn't mean a foreclosure sale. It means that, and somebody correct me if I'm wrong here on this, a filing for foreclosure means that they're moving ahead with a sale. It doesn't mean that there were that many sales in 2009 as much as it was that there were proceedings towards sales. And sometimes, you know, you get into that foreclosure proceeding and the homeowner and the lender work things out.
Any correction of that? You can go on up.
I could answer that question. The Realty Track data.
You need this on the record.
I don't do this often. I don't know the procedures.
And your name as well.
Steve Emery, again.
To answer your question, Representative, the Realty Track Data is a company that sells foreclosure filings on the internet to investors and real estate agents, and it's in their interest to have as many filings as possible. It sells more subscriptions and more website hits. On a foreclosure, you have an initial filing, which is a notice of default, then you have a notice of sale, and then the property is actually sold. So in Oregon, we get three for every one foreclosure, and that's if they only do each of those steps once. Many lenders will file a notice of default repeatedly on the same property, and then a notice of sale repeatedly on the same property. So what ends up happening is one foreclosure can maybe have six or seven or eight activities. So you really, I mean, some of these questions, I mean, I could spend an hour talking about the details and just really bore you, but, you know, the Realty Track data is not our favorite data from the industry. We prefer the Mortgage Bankers data, our CoreLogic, which actually tracks actual foreclosures.
May I follow up just, and I won't drag this out. So, of the data you prefer, what would the number be comparable to the number that we're reading here from Realty Track?
I have not actually looked at the data for CoreLogic or the Mortgage Bankers data in about 2 years since I was on the Mortgage Lending Work Group and working on that stuff extensively, but I know in the Mortgage Lending Work Group we threw out the Realty Track data. Oregon's in, you know, there's also in the foreclosures what you have is two different sets of data that everybody talks about in the press, and that's the acceleration, how quickly it's growing, and also the raw number of how many are being done, and then also you'll see how many are being done per how many homes. And the Realty Track data might be one to look at on that, is how many foreclosures are happening per how many homes. I believe the Realty Track data is somewhere around 329 right now, which is up from the 900 level that we were at a couple of years ago. But the real problem area is, I mean, not that every single foreclosure is not a problem. I mean, for that individual, it's horrible. But the numbers in the areas that are hardest hit are like one out of 25 homes, one out of 45 homes. Those are the really hard hit. Our numbers have accelerated in Oregon, but the actual numbers, I would argue that the Business Journal saying we were ninth in the nation was inaccurate, is my premise. And could I answer one other quick point from a question about licensing? One thing that also happens with licensing now, with the National SAFE Act being passed in Oregon, is if I lose my license in Oregon, I lose my license in every state in the country.
Mr. Hanna. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, you all know we heard some information given on the floor of the House today and asked this specific question, and that's why I was trying to get to the bottom of the number, because it was interesting to me that the total of foreclosures just in Multnomah County was 6,407. Obviously, there's some dispute about the total number, but the total in the state, over 34,000. Hopefully, somebody can give us a number, verifiable number.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you to both. And I would like to have our people from DCBS and from the Attorney General's Office come up, just because we did hear last week, and I want to make sure the people get a chance to hear from them as well. And any questions you might have.
Okay.
And so that people know, we are going to carry, well, we'll wait till we get ready to do it, but carry this one over to a work session tomorrow, just because we don't have all the paperwork we have to have. Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I did just comment briefly last week primarily on the portion of the bill that relates to the regulatory issues, which is Section 6 of the bill and the Dash 1 amendments. I heard some of the earlier witnesses testify that it is a break on DOJ, and I would not describe it that way. We have great respect for DOJ and full confidence in their judgment. What we and DOJ both felt, however, is that with limited state resources, it's best not to have duplication of effort and have two agencies really with overlapping responsibility. So what that portion of the bill is intended to do is to say that for those areas where Department of Consumer and Business Services already does regulation and enforcement, we would keep primary jurisdiction for regulation and enforcement, but could refer cases to DOJ as the need arises. So that those were really the gist of the comments that I made last week, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Do you have an idea of the number of foreclosures?
Mr. Chair, we do have that data, but not with us, okay. Unfortunately. We can bring it to your hearing tomorrow.
Okay, that'd be great.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Keith Dubanovich. I'm Chief of Staff and Special Counsel to the Attorney General. Ms. Streisinger is correct in that the Dash 1 amendments are an effort to clarify precisely the responsible agency for both regulatory and enforcement activities in the loan and lending area. The Department of Justice is not interested in taking on the regulatory responsibilities. DCBS already does a good job in that. What we perceive this bill to do is to fill a gap in enforcement that presently exists, and that is over financial institutions that are involved in loans and extensions of credit that are not presently regulated by any state agency, and those are primarily, of course, national banks. At the present time, the Department of Justice is not involved in pursuing investigations against national banks that are involved in the financial crisis simply because our UTPA does not apply to loans and lending. However, there are attorneys general offices across the country that are working together to do these investigations. We just are simply not participating because our law does not apply to those kind of institutions. We would certainly be willing to investigate the matter. Representative Berger, you asked a question of what would happen if the law applied. I think the answer is correct, and that is that the consumer might have a cause of action individually against that bank. The Department of Justice, if presented with a complaint by that consumer, would investigate like we do any other consumer complaints. And while we don't actually represent the individual consumer, we attempt to bring the business and the consumer together in an effort to resolve the dispute. So that's essentially how we would approach that matter.
Any other questions for either?
Yes,
a quick one, and I suspect we may have the benefit of their expertise tomorrow as well. But there's been a fair amount made about existing regulation and existing mechanisms that agencies of the state have to protect consumers. But aren't there other industries that are regulated or licensed or registered by the state that are subject to the existing UTPA?
Chair Roblin, Representative Nolan, virtually every single business activity in the state of Oregon is subject to the UTPA except for lending, extensions of credit, and insurance. And that means architects, engineers, accountants, lawyers, doctors, to the telecommunications industry, your local water company, the electric company, all of those entities that are heavily regulated by the state, their activities are nonetheless still subject to the UTPA.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you both. We're going to close our public hearing on 3706, House Bill 3706. Committee, we are going to have a meeting at 2:30 tomorrow. We'll find out the room and get that out to everybody. And we will have a work session on House Bill 3673, House Bill 3706. We already mentioned that we would have one on 3704 and 3638. I think I've got all the amendments for that one as well. And so we'll, so those will be work sessions tomorrow. Any questions?
Some of us will have ways and means at 3:30.
Right. That's why we're going to try to work sessions go quickly, see what we can do. With that, I think we close our hearing. We'll close our rules meeting for today. Thanks for staying so late. I appreciate everybody's work on this.